Welcome back, Baseball America College Baseball Podcast. I'm Jacob Rudner, joined by Jeff Ponce, and this is the penultimate regular season episode of the pod. Jeff, how are you? And what's exciting to you about college baseball lately?
I'm doing pretty good, Jacob. Can't complain. I think it's, you know, we're building up the tournament time. We actually have some tournaments kicking off this weekend, at least in the Patriot League. As far as like postseason baseball, they have a four team sort of playoff thing. That'll be interesting to sort of follow as they're one of the first leagues, if not the first league to do that, or conference. Pardon me, I said league, should say conference. I think, you know, this time of year is arguably the best time of the year. You see guys kind of emerging late in the season, boosting their draft stock. Maybe a guy like Cade McDonald, who's had a heck of a run since he was inserted into that DH role for Florida over the last couple of weeks. But also you're seeing, you know, the top 25, like the actual host seeding sort of start to take place. Some teams have kind of all but confirmed that. Others are still on the bubble. That's always a lot of fun to watch. And you're building up to, you know, the regionals, the super regionals, all of, you know, postseason college baseball, which for my money, I love college basketball. I love the tournament. This to me, in my world, this is the best thing. There is nothing better than these playoffs, even more so than MLB, whatever. Like, I look forward to the college postseason because so much zany stuff happens. There's teams that emerge that nobody anticipated would make an Omaha run that do. And you know, it's sometimes it's kind of every man kind of team. So just think it adds a different element than what we see in professional sports or high level basketball and certainly high level football at the college level. So all that stuff. And then the Cape Cod League is a little bit more than a month away. So I'm obviously always kind of intently following those rosters, who's coming, who's not coming, who I think will come and won't come. So it could be a really exciting summer. And, you know, that's when, my full-fledged college baseball looks really take a huge step forward. And, you know, I'm seeing dozens upon dozens of, you know, quality college talent every night out here on the Cape. So, yeah, I'm excited, man. I'm excited for the next couple of weeks and the last couple of weeks, and some of the excitement within the top 25 has been a blast to follow. So my very long-winded answer to your question.
No, that was beautiful, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people who will appreciate that, especially the sentiment about how the college postseason is better than any other postseason. You heard it here first. That's how Jeff feels. We have news to talk about at the top of our show, and you can read about all this, by the way, in a lot of cases sooner than we're going to talk about it on the podcast. If you head on over to baseballamerica.com/college, that's where all of our written content is, and this is one of the things, one of the many things that is up there. We're going to see ABS in college. The ball strike challenge system is coming to college. It will be a part of the SEC tournament this year on an experimental basis. How that works, the SEC basically went to the NCAA rules committee and said, we have the infrastructure to try this. Can we do so? They said yes. And so in Hoover, Alabama this year, the SEC tournament will come down to some player challenges and coach challenges on the ball and strike front. It is going to mirror the way that it works in the major leagues. Same setup. It's based off of a player's measurements. It will be camera tracked, and it will go to somebody beyond the field for whether or not the call is correct. Teams have three challenges, and it's going to be interesting. This is the first time this has been a part of college baseball. You, obviously, as our prospect extraordinaire at Baseball America, have been watching this all year. In the minors, you saw it, and you've seen it, obviously, in the major leagues. The fans have seen it in the major leagues now. Generally, before we get into the nitty-gritty of all of this, is this something that excites you? What does this do for college baseball and amateur baseball?
Yeah, it's a loaded question. I just want to say that I do have Prospect Extraordinaire on my Baseball America business cards. That's actually my official title. I appreciate you acknowledging that, Jacob. But in all seriousness, I've seen it for a few years now in AAA. I saw the full ABS system, which I thought was bad when it was calling every ball and strike. And you know, the margin for error in terms of pitches that maybe wouldn't be challenged on a challenge night, that were called balls or strikes, and sometimes by like a quarter of an inch. And the zone was really small. It was a little frustrating. So that's the first thing. I think it's going to shrink the actual strike zone. Even if it's a strike zone that on TV, you're used to the box, you think it's a good zone, there will be some calls that you typically thought was a strike years ago that goes for a ball and is like a really astute challenge. Other times it's going to be up to the umpire. I like the fact that, you know, there is a balance of the human element still exists, and there's a strategic element in terms of how you use your challenges. I'm sure that if, you know, teams are smart, and I assume that they will be, and they have people on staff that focus on this kind of stuff, they'll sort of know who's allowed to challenge and who's not allowed to challenge. There will be some batters that I'm sure are not going to be allowed to challenge. But, you know, your guys that have higher walk rates, good plate discipline, those guys are probably going to have consistently the green light. Typically what I've seen in AAA, and this wasn't 100% in the beginning, so it might be a mixed bag in the SEC tournament. Pitchers typically aren't allowed to challenge just simply because they tend to be a little bit more selfish with that. And it's funny, the first person that talked to me about this strategy was actually Colson Montgomery, now White Sox star and you know, power hitter, middle of the order for him now. But at that time, it was the first year that he had played with it. I kind of asked him some questions. We had a long conversation at the prospect pad in Arlington and talked for like 30 minutes about it. And he kind of talked about the strategy, how there are certain guys that were on his Charlotte team that weren't allowed to challenge, other guys that always had that green light, and that their team had sort of said, we always go into the eighth inning with a challenge, that, you know, regardless of what happens, even if it's a bad call, we tend to have the philosophy of like, let's keep a challenge for those last two innings, just in case it's a close game, something happens, et cetera, et cetera. The other part of it is catchers tended to handle the challenges and not pitchers. And his whole point was that pitchers will be a little bit selfish, that they'll think they got a strike and maybe be a little bit too aggressive with it, where a catcher probably, you know, seeing pitches constantly behind the plate, seeing balls and strikes, knowing the zone really well is all part of that position. You've seen so many pitches and clock so many pitches. Once you get to the a college baseball and the SEC, you've caught a lot of innings in your career. They tend to have a better feel for the strike zone. Those guys tend to be the head tap and the challenge. I think the other interesting element of this to me, Jacob, from a draft perspective, from a prospect perspective, we're going to know the hitters' heights. It's not the same for the pitchers, but we're going to know all these hitters' heights. So a lot of guys that are sneaking by, listening to themselves, 5'10", that are actually 5'7", 5'8", it's going to get exposed. The guys who aren't 6 feet tall, it's going to get exposed. So kind of a bunch of interesting elements here, but I think the strategy is going to be real exciting. And I think it kills some of the question marks around some of the really bad calls that we might see from game to game. Those are easy challenges really in any sort of situation.
Sure.
Three balls outside and it's like, all right, head tap, easy. That's an easy flip. We're not going to lose that challenge. You'll see a lot of those. But it does, you know, hold the umpires accountable as well in terms of how they're calling balls and strikes. It will be interesting because I'll add this other element into it. I know I'm kind of like throwing a lot at you right now, but the other thing is, and I think this is standardized a little bit more, especially now that it's gotten to the majors. The strike zones from system to system, from park to park early on over the first few years of AAA were very different. If I remember correctly, Worcester had like a higher strike zone than Syracuse did, which had like a lower zone. And so hitters were kind of feeling it out the first day of a six-game series, because that's what the slates are in AAA now post-pandemic. They would sort of feel it out the first game and be like, all right, it's a low zone, it's a high zone. Usually the width is pretty even in terms of how it plays off the plate. They do a pretty good job of that. But I think that height in terms of like the top of the zone, bottom of the zone, it can fluctuate. Obviously, it's played in one park, but it'll be interesting to see if it's a high or a low zone kind of based on feedback, maybe from, you know, catchers and pitchers and hitters after that tournament. Might be a interesting article idea. So
look out for that. Look out for that at Baseball America. This has been a long time coming for the SEC. They talked about before the season wanting to do this. You can actually read that story that we wrote before the season about the reporting on the desire for ABS. The biggest challenge for the SEC, though, in doing this was that the NCAA has made it very clear that this is not an accessible system for the rest of college baseball in normal times. There are more teams that cannot afford to put in Hawkeye, which is the generally accepted system that runs these ABS systems. It's too expensive for the vast majority of college baseball. And so the NCAA has been very reluctant to do that. Before the season, the word on the street in conversations with sources was that this wasn't going to happen until 2027 at the earliest, and it was probably going to still be in this SEC tournament, you know, one stadium, one league. It's 1 week of the season that's not really impactful. The SEC tournament, I will also say, you know, outside of the team that wins it for the most part, is not a terribly impactful tournament from a NCAA standpoint. I think the teams that are in the SEC that are going to get in are already in for the most part, and the teams that are out are pretty clearly out. There's usually one or two exceptions. And so to debut this there and have it be in kind of a, I don't want to call it a faux important environment because it is important, but it is kind of a lower stress in-season situation to be trying out something like this. The surprise, again, is that it's coming sooner, that it's a 2026 debut. But from everything that I've gathered, it seems like those in the college umpiring community are not so upset about this. I think that they viewed this as inevitable, first of all. So maybe some of these guys have had some runway to kind of come to terms with the fact that this was coming to the college game. And the other element to this is, this is a very honest assessment, I've heard from a couple umpires that, you know, just generally speaking, there's a lot of umps at that level in the college game who aren't perfect, who make some bad calls, and they become kind of internet sensations for their misses because they are more egregious at times than you see at the professional level. Not to say that there aren't egregious misses there too, but for those guys, I think the hope from the umpiring side is that they kind of become less of a highlight. You know, bad calls have a chance to be erased and more of a, you know, just kind of happenstance of the game that goes by. So it seems like something that's generally supported. I think the questions are, how cleanly does it operate? You know, from a player standpoint, they do have a third challenge. You mentioned kind of the inaccuracies of who's exactly doing it. The pitchers are maybe too aggressive. Well, because these guys are amateurs, they get three. In the professional game, they get two. They will still get extra calls in extra innings as they do in the professional level. And so, you know, I think they're kind of giving a runway for this to work. I also know that teams were practicing this over the fall because there was some anticipation across the league that this was coming eventually. So I don't think it's foreign to anybody. I think these umpires are equipped to be able to handle it. It sounds like the technology is in place and very easily accessible for a league like the SEC. And now it becomes a question, like you just said, of how well do some of these teams run it? And it'll be interesting to see which SEC teams are the best prepared as well. In addition to, is it a high zone? Is it a lower zone? Is Vandy the best team at the ABS game? Is it Tennessee? Is it Florida? I'll be interested to see that as well. So a cool change for college baseball that personally, I hope it sticks.
I'm going to throw out one name that I think could be impactful with this system at the plate and behind it. It's Ryder
Helfrich. ABS prediction. Okay.
Yeah. Ryder Helfrich. I mean, knows the strike zone fairly well. I think you see that when he's at the plate. He's also one of the best framers. So he's, I feel like he's
the best framer by some metrics.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, one of the best framers. I don't want to say absolutely with, you know, all full authority. There's sure. Some other names in the mix, but he is one of the best framers in college baseball based on the data. And that tends to tell me that you have like those guys that tends to translate at the plate, like from what I've seen. And then behind it, the best framers were usually the best challengers in AAA. Because they're guys that know when they're stealing a strike and like, you know, kind of how the ball moves, sure. All that sort of stuff. Because I think to be able to even frame like that, like you're seeing very well and anticipating and sort of targeting with your pocket, which is how you're able to sort of do all that. My son's a catcher, so I've gotten really nerdy on catching over the last couple of years. But yeah, so I think Ryder Helfrich could maybe boost him a little bit too, you know, be like, wow, knows how to challenge.
If we're gonna, first of all, that's very true. If we're going to go just purely by strikes framed, which is, this is an, maybe you can speak to this better than I can, but this is an imperfect thing that I'm about to say, because this is, I don't know if this is a drilled down enough data point between how balls and strikes are tracked across college baseball to be, you know, the authority. I don't know that this should rule the conversation, but just to give kind of a general picture, okay? In total strikes framed, these are the SEC leaders at the moment. And if I miss somebody, it's because I'm live reading a spreadsheet to you. Ryder Helfrich is first. And then you have to go a long, long ways to get to Austin Folly at Ole Miss, has been actually very good in just overall called strikes via framing. And third in the SEC is Daniel Jackson at Georgia, who's having a fantastic season. So to Jeff's point, those are, Jackson and Helfrich for sure, are a couple of guys who you go out and you have a couple of good games on the framing front, and you have a couple of good games on the strikes called on the challenge system front. What does that do for a guy's draft stock? That, Jeff, is a very interesting point.
It's an interesting wrinkle, you know. Yeah, I don't know if it matters all that much at all, but it is something that you're going to see in the big leagues, right? And, you know, it's you know, people say that, you know, framing can be devalued, and I think to an extent it is, but when there's still an umpire there and they're very close, like,
yeah,
kind of a matter of like razor thin margins sometimes in that shadow zone in terms of what you're kind of stealing. But also just being able to use those challenges effectively too. Like, I think that's really a skill, particularly for catchers. That's super valuable, as we talked about, just the strategy of them typically being kind of the field general and the guy that's going to make those calls.
Yeah. There you go. Okay, we are going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about the back of the Baseball America Top 25. We'll be right back after this.
You know, we don't always have to do things because that's how it's always been.
Look, people consider me old school, and I thought I was, but then we had the pitch clock and the ABS and ban on shifts and all these things that we've had for a long time in baseball. And you know what? Much like Mint Mobile and the other mobile carriers, I'm here for the new school and the changes that have been made.
It's a good call. You can ditch overpriced wireless. You don't have to say, oh, I'm paying that, because that's how it's always been. Get 3 months of premium wireless service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. If you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/territory. That's mintmobile.com/territory. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month 5 gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available, taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details. Get after it, FT fam.
Jeff, this time of year, I feel like there is a group of teams that gets ignored just by the flow of the conversation. And it's our fault. I'm not blaming anybody but us. But we do ignore this group. The top of the BA Top 25 gets talked about a lot. Obviously, those are the best teams in the country. I think the middle of the poll kind of gets talked about a decent amount as well, because those are the teams that are knocking on the door of hosting. Those are the teams that are pushing into the top 10 every single week.
I think we spend some
time. Exactly, or dropping out. I think we talk a lot about some teams that are off of the poll, because those are the teams that are kind of making noise in the at-large conversation. But the one group that gets lost in all of this is like the last six teams on the BA Top 25. And today, we're going to spend the second half of our show talking about them. I will name them in order. 19, Arizona State. 20, Cincinnati. 21, Boston College. 22, Alabama. 23, Oregon. 24, Jacksonville State. 25, Oklahoma State. Those are the last teams in the BA Top 25 as of May 5th. Again, this is the Week 13 Top 25, Week 1 being the preseason poll. Jeff, you actually handled the studying of these teams at the end of our week this week. Let's start with Arizona State. I think that there is a real case to be made that this is one of the most talented teams west of the Mississippi. You have Landon Harrison in the outfield, who's a legitimate player of the year contender, if not at this point the runaway favorite. You have Cole Carlone, who has emerged as a massive helium draft prospect, who some people are talking about in the top 20 conversation. He's got a fastball up to 100. And you have a supporting cast around those two guys who are talented, and some guys draft prospects in their own right. And right now, they're 19th in the country. It's an interesting 19. They're 33 and 15 overall, 16-8, which is tied for second in the Big 12 with West Virginia, who they lost to at home. But Arizona State at the moment is sitting at number 39 in the RPI. We have them as a pretty prominent two seed, which kind of flies in the face of the RPI right now. But that is a very fragile resume at the moment. They kind of have to be perfect the rest of the way, do they not?
Yeah, and I think it's funny because we tend to think about Arizona State as maybe not like a premier baseball program any longer, but like a perennial top 25 type of contender. They're always sort of in the mix. Certainly a ton of talent on that team, particularly on the, you know, the hitting side, the positional side. They're ninth in team WOBA in Division One. You know, teams ahead of them are like Georgia Tech, Georgia, Mercer, Farley Dickinson, Pittsburgh, Texas A&M, Texas, Miami, Ohio. So you'd like think about where they fall within kind of power five conferences. They're like a top 4-7 type of, you know, run producing offense. And then on the other side, they're pretty poor despite, you know, Cole Carlone being a top draft prospect. And I think feel like somebody that I write about every week, my data breakouts, whether it's about whiffs that he's generating off that slider or, you know, the power on the fastball. He's always sort of within the max velocity leaders from week to week, but they're 148th right now in FIP. And that's actually a little friendlier than ERA is to them. Just to kind of put things into perspective where they're, you know, outside of the top 150 in terms of team ERA. Now, the run environment that they play in and kind of within that conference is a little bit elevated, you know, certainly we'll give them some sake there, but there are other teams that play at elevation that play in that conference that have significantly better overall pitching numbers. I think that's what the concern is. They can slug with anybody. Are they going to be able to keep enough runs off the board? And then you take a step back again. This is one of the reasons we've been skeptical with them, despite being a very exciting offense. And I think, frankly, one of the more watchable teams. Anytime you have Landon Harrison in that lineup, it's
good players help.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know, 76th strength of schedule really hurts them a lot in terms of an RPI perspective, but also what you're talking about in terms of them kind of walking this razor thin margin. They've had a couple of big series, back to back to back, take out BYU, sweep Baylor, take 2 out of 3 from a good UCF team who's kind of been on and off of the top 25, and they're a top 30 RPI team, or at least we're kind of heading into the week. Now they have to go and play a home series, but against Oklahoma State, who someone will talk about at the end of this segment, who's really been trending up for the last couple of weeks to a month plus. That's a really tough series. It's going to decide a lot about what happens with Arizona State. But at the same time, if they do win out, there's a good chance that, you know, maybe they're on the host bubble. I don't know if they get there, but they could be a pretty high two seed. They're an interesting team, but I think that it is kind of two sides of the coin with them. I don't know if you agree or disagree that they're going to go as long as their lineup is going to carry them, because it's probably not going to be pitching outside of outstanding performances from Carlone.
Yeah, I think there's a couple interesting things there. First, I don't think that the host line is really in sight off of the regular season alone. I think that Oklahoma State is a really big RPI boost that could happen if they win that series. I think that Houston is more of the kind of series that's going to hurt you if you lose it and not really do a whole lot for you if you win it. They're 1/10 in RPI. It's at Houston, which does play to Arizona State's favor marginally. But at this stage in the game, when you are 39th in RPI, it's going to take miracle work to get into a position where you're going to host. Now, that being said, there is still the Big 12 tournament. You have opportunities to go beat good teams there. You make a run to, say, the championship game. And this is, it's hard to say this because I think that how far you need to go in the conference tournament is dictated a lot by what teams are doing elsewhere in their respective conference tournaments and how kind of the back of the host bubble and the high two seeds are moving in that sense as well. But if you get to a championship game in the Big 12 tournament, effectively in your own backyard, and you're Arizona State, yeah, I think that there's a conversation to be had about, you know, is this a team that is the 16th host? Is this a team that's from, you know, 17 to 20, which is, I think, the conversation that's a lot more likely for this team at this point. But yes, to your point, very exciting team, fun to watch. And on the pitching, I actually think this is a team that has this sneaky potential to just kind of click at some point here down the stretch on the mound. Yes, the offense will carry this. Yes, they have a 5.34 ERA, which is really low. However, they are seventh right now in the country in total strikeouts, so they miss a ton of bats. They're among the national leaders in team whiffs. They're just missing bats all the time. Carlone, obviously, you know, kind of carries you in that sense. But this is the best whiff rate team Arizona State has ever had, to my knowledge. In terms of the researchable years, which I believe it was back to 2019, it is absolutely the best team that ASU has had from a whiff rate standpoint. So my question to you is, does a team that misses a lot of bats like this, and they do walk their fair share, do they have a chance to kind of round into form at the end here with the talent that they have and the stuff that they have?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's from a lack of talent, but I do think like a lack of execution, maybe in, you know, more neutral run environments, all of a sudden they pitch a little bit better. Pitchers are moving a little bit differently, all that sort of thing. It's just hard to bank on it, but I don't think you're wrong that there's, you know, enough talent here that they could just get hot at the right time and be really effective in postseason play. But just kind of looking objectively at the numbers to date, they haven't been good.
No, they do allow a lot of runs. And again, also, you know, it's worth mentioning that that is a ballpark that plays very much to offenses. It's very small. The run environment in Arizona in general is pretty favorable for offensive players, but you do still have to get outs, and Arizona State does not necessarily do that consistently. Another team in the Big 12 that has an interesting resume, they're 20th in our poll, that's Cincinnati. Cincinnati is a 32-win team. They're 32-17. They are now 13-11 in the Big 12, which is really the big discussion that we're going to get into here in a second. And they look like a really high two seed, given the fact that they are 22 in RPI right now, and their remaining series, providing they go the way that one would expect, at Kansas State, at Texas Tech, will put them in position to basically stay where they're at RPI-wise and have at least, in my opinion, 17 conference wins in a reasonably competitive Big 12. I like this team. I'll speak for J.J. Cooper. He loves this team. And I know that there are a couple of draft guys for you that you kind of have had your eye on with Cincinnati for a while. I will not speak for you. Where do you stand with the Bearcats? Is this the kind of team that you would not want to face in the postseason?
Yeah, I mean, Coates is very interesting. You know, certainly same with Nathan Taylor, who I find to be pretty interesting. It's funny, this team in some ways is very similar in terms of what their strengths and weaknesses are to Arizona State. I don't think they have as much pitching talent, and that kind of shows up in the numbers. I mean, they have a 5.99 ERA to date. The FIP's a little bit better, but not much. But they are, you know, a top 30-ish offense based on WOBA and a bunch of other different metrics. I think you kind of look at that lineup. They have a couple of underclass guys that have really hit this year as well. And they've been hot lately. You know, they've won some big 12, it's redundant, games. They've won five in a row. They swept Houston this weekend. They took 2 out of 3 from West Virginia, and the one loss came on Friday night in 13 innings. So, you know, they've really kind of continued to impress in conference. You know, 13-11. I think, you know, looking at what the remaining calendar is, Kansas State, Texas Tech, I think it's reasonable to think they could get to maybe 17 wins, you know, in the Big 12. The strength of schedule was actually pretty good. They have 10 Q1 wins as well. I think you sort of look at them as a team that with a strong finish could also play themselves into a higher two seed and could be kind of a dangerous draw for some teams, some host teams too. I think Cincinnati is kind of sneaky in terms of maybe being an Omaha sleeper. So, I like this team a lot. I think RPI kind of backs a lot of that. But it is, you know, another team where there's two sides of the coin here, and they kind of have this one ace who's maybe not as good as Carlone, but has some very interesting traits and is a draft prospect. But overall, the staff hasn't performed, and it's really been the lineup that's been carrying them.
Yeah, this is, it's kind of unfortunate because if you, like me, are skeptical, I'll put it that way, of RPI and its, you know, true utility and accuracy for the tournament selection process, this is like a bad case for you right here with Cincinnati, because in this instance, you have RPI kind of getting it right. This is a team that kind of struggled in conference play. They had a conference record that was lacking for a while, but RPI kept saying, this is a good team, this is a good team. And now it kind of feels like we're forced to catch up with it a little bit because the strength of schedule has been good. The conference wins and losses is just a lot more sightly, which I think was Cincinnati's biggest issue for a while. And the overall record has honestly always been fine. It's now very good. So this is kind of one of those things where it's like you hat tip to the RPI formula and it's, you know, you got it right. And the tournament committee will point to this and be like, see, these are the situations that justify using this metric.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's interesting too is when you kind of break it into like, you know, Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4, they've played like the same number of Q1 games as like most SEC teams have, which is unusual for a team kind of outside of, you know, the SEC, frankly. Like you don't see that even with a lot of these ACC teams. So that's certainly a big feather in their cap in terms of the resume.
Yeah, and it's also probably a good example of like last year, Xavier was the team that played the hardest schedule, the hardest non-con schedule in the country. I believe they finished the year, you know, top 20 at least in overall strength of schedule, and they did not make the tournament because they didn't win a lot of those quad one games. I'll pull it up here right now. Hold on. Xavier last year was left out of the tournament at 42nd. In RPI, I think it was better at the time of the selection process. 37th in strength of schedule, and their non-con SOS, non-con strength of schedule, finished at 5th. But they went 5-13 in quad one games. And so the committee basically said on selection Monday, we understand that they challenged themselves. That's great. But they didn't win those games. So what does it matter? Like, you don't get rewarded for losing tough games. You get rewarded for winning tough games. And I think that in Cincinnati's case, even if those teams that they've beaten early in the season, I'm talking the UABs of the world, no offense to the UABs of the world, but that is not, you know, a big ticket game that I think people will look at and say, oh, this is a team that really challenged itself. But I think that if you're looking at it from a who's good this year and in the tournament picture, Cincinnati has played a formidable schedule. They opened their year with a series win at Jacksonville State. Jacksonville State is knocking on the door of 40 wins right now. They've lost 4 conference games in Conference USA, which if you're going to sit and tell me that Conference USA is not competitive, you should watch more college baseball. They split a 4-game weekend with UAB. UAB has been kind of fringy, was better at one point. I would argue they were better then when they played that series. UC San Diego has been pesky. They have a win over UCLA. BYU is good, and you get into the conference play. BYU's been good. Utah, they got at home. Utah's been better than they've been in years past. Lose a series but get one against Kansas, which has been very tough to come by. I think the series that sticks out to me negatively would be getting swept at Oklahoma State, but even that at this point is looking better. So, yes, C has played a good schedule. They've won those games. Even if the conference record was not in the position it's in, they didn't have kind of the win tally boosting games that they have the rest of the way, I think this is a pretty comfy 2-seed team just because of who they've played and who they've beaten. We like Cincinnati, and that's why we got them at 20. You, Jeff, love Boston College. That has been a team that you, I'll even go as far as to say you've been rooting for them. You just want to see Boston College get a regional so you can go somewhere on the opening week of tournament play. They are 24th in RPI, 35-16 overall, excellent. 17-10 in the ACC, also very good. The strength of schedule drags them down a little bit at 64th overall right now. I don't see it at this point, the path to getting to a host spot after losing a series to Clemson, but you do have Georgia Tech left on the schedule. Is this a team that you think is doomed as far as the host picture goes, or Do you have an upset in you if you're Boston College, last week of the season at home against Georgia Tech?
I mean, like, I don't think it would just have to be an upset either. I honestly think they might have to sweep.
Probably.
If they're going to get a host. And I think the other thing too that's playing against them is just geography and having to play up here. I tend to think that, like, you know, the committee is not looking to go this far north. Even though there's some teams up in the Northeast that, you know, have auto bids, etc. I just don't think they're looking to do that. So BC has to sort of win out, frankly, I think, to even have a case for hosting. I think they could have lost one game to Clemson. They lose on Saturday. It's a bad day. Clemson jumps on you early. They get a bunch of runs. You can't come back in that game. That one run loss on Sunday hurts them. And the thing is, Clemson, from an RPI perspective, would have kind of boosted them a little bit. So that second win, or second loss on Sunday, really puts a dark cloud over their hosting ability here. And, you know, I mean, this is a team that has really kind of underperformed from, overperformed from like a wins and losses perspective. It's not an outstanding lineup by any measure. They're not top 100 in WOBA in college baseball. You know, they hit for a high average. They put the ball in play. They walk. They don't strike out that much. So they kind of play a little bit more like of a traditional style of offense, which is great. It's tough to do that game after game after game when you can't really slug with some of the teams, you know, at the top of the rankings in college baseball. I think that's a problem. And the pitching, after being kind of too good for a while, has really started to slide back over the last couple of weeks. So I just don't see it happening. I do think they'll be a higher two seed, and that's ultimately where they're going to end up. Unless they really drop the ball this weekend with, you know, a two game set with NJIT and then get swept at Georgia Tech, and then maybe things change a little bit. They have enough conference wins, a good enough conference schedule, enough wins overall that I do think they're kind of firmly in that two seed point, and probably won't do a whole lot to drop out of it or move up without a catastrophic failure or, you know, an insane run here at the end of the year. And like I said, they'd have to sweep Georgia Tech, and I just don't think that's going to happen.
Right. And the other thing that has to be mentioned here is that, you know, there is also the world in which the conference tournament factors into all of this. Everything that we're saying, for the most part, when it comes to, do you think they can host? And then Jeff talks about the schedule. That's not baking in, you know, they go on to win the ACC tournament.
And we can't predict that. Exactly.
No, we can't. And that's my point. You know, that could happen for sure. And if it does happen, it's going to be a great run. And the conversation will change about where Boston College, or really any team for that matter, belongs as far as the power conference picture goes. But just with the regular season schedule that they have left and where they're at in the RPI, yeah, I would tend to agree. You got to be perfect here. You can't lose to NJIT. That's for certain. And then you have Georgia Tech, which is kind of your opportunity to get things on the right track. But even that, if you don't sweep it, I don't know that it's enough at this point in the game. It's close, but I don't know if it's enough. Not without help, at least. That is going to be the last team we talk about before a break. We're going to come back and talk about Bama, Oregon, Jack State, and Oklahoma State.
You care about helping others learn and grow. And now you can make an even greater difference. The Ohio State University's fully online master's in applied behavior analysis prepares you to help learners with disabilities thrive. You'll develop the skills to use evidence-based interventions that enhance learning outcomes and foster independence, all in a flexible format designed for working professionals. With growing demand for board-certified behavior analysts, this online program helps you prepare for what's next, without pausing your life. If you're ready to expand your impact, Ohio State is ready to support your next step. Visit go.osu.edu/behavioranalysis.
The Crimson Tide have had a unique season for us because we have been at points very low on them. That was at the beginning of the season. At one point, I didn't even have them in the tournament. That's going to be my biggest miss. I have no problem admitting it. At some points, we have had them inside the top 10 and a very prominent host. And then they lost three weekends in a row. They dropped to the back of the top 25. That's still kind of where they're hanging out. RPI-wise, though, they get a lot of help. They are currently sitting at number 5, which is what allowed us to put them above the host line in our latest projection. Alabama is the number 13 national seed. The margin for error there is very slim if you are the Crimson Tide. I think, again, that the metrics, you know, you're 13-11 in the SEC, a team that's going to finish multiple games over 500 in that league is going to be looked at very favorably, especially with a top 5, top 10 RPI. They're 13-9 in quad 1. But with the record, with the losing weekends in the last couple weeks, if you don't take care of business at South Carolina, and then you come back to Tuscaloosa for the last weekend of the regular season, you don't take care of business at home against Ole Miss, a very good Ole Miss team, I do not think this is an Alabama host team. I think that it is a clear top two. But if you are not going to take care of these last two weekends, no way does the committee keep them above the host line. For now, yes, though.
Yeah, and I mean, prior to this, they were on arguably the best run in college baseball, you know, kind of at the end of March, beginning of April, where, you know, they ran off, was it 10 wins in a row, took series, swept a series from Florida, swept a series, you know, at home against rival Auburn, which is a big one now, especially when you're sort of looking back, take 2 out of 3 from Oklahoma. And then like immediately, it was a gauntlet of a schedule. We can't debate or argue that, you know. You know, it's based on strength of schedule. They're 3rd in the country behind, you know, Auburn and then Florida, fellow SEC rivals. But they get swept, you know, at home against Arkansas. They then drop 2 out of 3 and, you know, kind of just salvaged on a Sunday at Texas. And then drop 2 out of 3 to Tennessee, who has been trending upward. And that was kind of their final jump or ascent. But at that point, we were still had major question marks about the sort of quality of those. They did what they were supposed to do this weekend at home against Vanderbilt. But as you said, what they do in these final two series, they can drop a game to South Carolina, but they need to take that series. And then, you know, Ole Miss and Alabama, depending upon what happens in the next couple of weeks, they're kind of might be battling it out for one of those final host spots as well. So South Carolina is a very nice draw for them here. Ole Miss is going to be a really tough series. So how these last 2 weeks go are really going to dictate that for Alabama, but they've played a very difficult schedule at points in the year. They look like one of the best teams in the country. They need to sort of prove it over these last couple weeks and kind of solidify that. So they have an opportunity to do it. We have them as a host right now. But I do think that could potentially change if they drop to South Carolina or drop to Ole Miss.
I will also say, I don't know that, it's funny because we just said the opposite about 5 minutes ago, but I don't know that this is the most favorable time to get South Carolina if you're Alabama. I'm getting the season wrecker vibes a little bit from South Carolina here. They're playing fine enough baseball is how I would describe it. Like, it's just not the team you want to face. And it's in Columbia. Is that a series that Alabama goes on the road and, you know, things get sloppy? They haven't played their best baseball in the last couple weeks. Justin LeBron's kind of this up-down player who could be really good at times, but at other times he kind of leaves you hanging. This is going to be the wrong time to have a bad week if you're Alabama.
It is the worst opponent, SEC opponent, they've played this year, though. So
Auburn,
Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, Tennessee, Vanderbilt. South Carolina, Ole Miss. But for a team
that has so much to prove, if you go into this weekend and you let your guard down because of what we're saying, because this is an easy weekend on paper, is this the kind of weekend that basically sinks your season from a hosting standpoint if you're Alabama? Because you can't lose it.
They can't drop the series.
Kind of a similar situation, but opposite coast of the country in a very different league. Oregon right now is kind of a confounding tournament profile. And we had a hard time with it yesterday. We've had a hard time with it in the top 25 because the reality is they don't play anybody that tough. I mean, not in the Big Ten. They didn't outside of conference play for the most part. It was non-conference RPI right now is 34, which is just solid. Strength of schedule overall is 99, so they have not faced the meat of the Big Ten. They're 27th again in RPI, 35-12, though, 17-7 in the league. Right now, we kind of have them as a mid-tier two. The one thing that could change that in a hurry with that kind of a win total is this weekend. They are at UCLA for three games. If you take that series, it is going to be extremely difficult for me to not start to think about a world in which UCLA, USC, and Oregon end up regional hosts.
Well, and they get USC the week after, right? Yep. So, like, if they take four out of six here, right, over their final two series, I think they're a host. One of the biggest issues with Oregon throughout the year is that strength of schedule. I think they are a bottom five among teams in the top 50 in RPI, for example. They have a bottom five strength of schedule. And they're a lot closer to those teams in Conference USA and the American and the MAC than they are to teams in, you know, the SEC, the ACC, and the Big 12. These are big RPI boosters for them. These wins will obviously do a number for them. And I think it will also sort of solidify them as a top 25 team, which we've been very skeptical on. Frankly, we've been kind of slow to adjust for reasons. But it will also, you know, put them into that host picture as well. So, yeah, I mean, they're on the top 25. I'm still a little skeptical with this team. I'd be interested to kind of get your breakdown on them. But, yeah, I'm still kind of on the line as to whether I fully believe in Oregon or not. Sorry, Josh Norris.
Yeah, our esteemed colleague Josh Norris is an Oregon grad. No, I'm with you, and I've written this before at BA as well. I am skeptical of Oregon from a metric standpoint. I don't like where Oregon's at in RPI. I don't like the strength of schedule. In the time that you were talking, you filibustered long enough. The only teams in the top 50 right now in RPI with a worse strength of schedule than number 99, Oregon, are mm-hmm. Jacksonville State, mm-hmm. UTSA, Mercer, Kent State, and Miami, Ohio. That's it. Everybody mm-hmm. else in the top 50 in RPI has played a tougher schedule than Oregon. But there is one, the only kind of path through on teams that play weak schedules is you got to win a ton of games. Because if you go and win a ton of games, it is going to allow you to be perceived in a better light than the teams that play poor schedules and don't win a ton of games, like win a lot, but not a ton. Iowa last year, great example of that, won a lot of games. I think it was close to 40, over 20 in conference, and they didn't make the tournament because the RPI was weak and they played a weak schedule and it wasn't enough wins. So I'm talking about a great amount of wins. Could Oregon get to that? Maybe. 35-12, those six games left, you're going to be right under 40. Is the strength of schedule that big of a deal if you're talking about a 40-win Oregon that's going to be with, if you win both of those series, and that's a huge if, probably 15th, 16th, no worse than that in the RPI right now? To me, it's an automatic host. And I'm not super skeptical of the talent.
No,
I'm skeptical of the resume.
They're a top 30 offense in WOBA. They're 28. Yep. You know, in terms of ERA, I think they're inside the top 40. FIP, they're like 88th. So there's some skepticism there. But
sure,
you know, in terms of the teams we're talking about, they're more balanced in terms of what they've done, what the data is that kind of backs it. It wouldn't be shocking to me. Let's say they drop two out of three against UCLA, but take a game. If you told me they're actually a better team than USC and that there was an opportunity that they could go in there and sweep, it wouldn't shock me. So, you know, how that final series comes together, because I don't think we expect them to be used. I think that USC coming to Oregon, that's a really nice setup for them for the last week of the season to sort of get into that, maybe that host picture and kind of eliminate USC potentially, who still doesn't have a quad one win.
No, USC right now is 0-8 in quad one games. And at the moment a host. Again, that's kind of just riding the metrics, since we know what we know the committee is going to try and do. And actually, I wrote this today, we may or may not disagree with it, but our job is projecting. And there are some people who come after us on Twitter. It's like, oh, of course they did this. Well, it's like, no, it's not really our decision. We're trying to forecast what other people are going to decide. This is not necessarily how we view it. And USC, I think, is one of the teams where it's like, would I put a team that has no quad one wins and eight opportunities as a host? No. Do I think that the committee will because they're a top 10 RPI team? Yes. And if you're Oregon, you're going to play that series under the assumption that at the moment that is an opportunity to beat a host. And do I think they're going to beat UCLA in a series in Westwood? No. But I do think you can go get a game, like Jeff said, and you can go to then, you know, play USC at home and do something that really changes the outlook on your season and where you're going to end up in the tournament. The other team that has played nobody at this point in this range is Jacksonville State. They are back in the top 25 at number 24. 20-4 in Conference USA, 38-10 overall. They have been dominant against Quad 1, 5-8. It's better than USC. And Quad 2, they're 7-0. So this is a team that has played some decent teams, even though their overall strength of schedule is 131. They've fared well in those games, and they are punishing Conference USA. They have been excellent in conference play. Right now, we have them and Liberty as two seeds. What are your thoughts on this Jacksonville State team?
Yeah, they've kind of been one of the more fun teams to follow throughout the year. And I think we felt as if, you know, when we looked at Conference USA, that they were probably the better team than Missouri State, despite the Missouri State position as an RPI darling. And they did us a big favor this weekend. You know, as they go to Missouri State and they take two out of three from Missouri State, who's still higher in RPI, but kind of solidified what we had been seeing. They get Kennesaw State and then Dallas Baptist, which is a tough series, over the final couple of weeks here of the season. But I think the thing that we've always been kind of impressed with Jacksonville State is, at least for me, their ability to produce a lot of runs despite not having the most loaded talent of the teams in the top 25. And some of the pitching talent that's on this team, despite them kind of being mediocre when it comes to some of the metrics, they punish Conference USA teams. I think a lot of it is it's a good offense. It's a good enough pitching staff. Maybe the numbers don't love it, but they're still pretty well balanced. And there's a couple of flamethrowers and guys in that staff that are kind of interesting that we've been, you know, digging in on the data side for a couple of months now.
Yeah, no. And if you go also, I haven't plugged this yet, but you head on over to baseballamerica.com right now. We have our list of 50 seniors that are out. We're ranking seniors. Jacksonville State lefty Bo Bryans way up there on that list. He's up to 98 with a sweeper. So yeah, fun names in Jacksonville State for sure. They're talented. They win a lot of games. And again, Conference USA, we know because historically there's a lot of evidence of this. Teams that perform this well in Conference USA and have this kind of RPI are two seeds without fail. So long as Jacksonville State doesn't get in its own way here down the stretch, it's a pretty automatic two seed bid. And pretty much at this point, the same can be said for Liberty because of the RPI. Do I think that three Conference USA teams are going to be two seeds? No. And it sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but right now Missouri State is 15-9 in Conference USA. And despite the RPI, something tells me that the committee will probably take the other two resumes, which have been better in quad one and two games. They haven't played the same kind of schedules, but against similarly strong competition, those two teams have been better, Liberty and Jacksonville State. So I think Missouri kind of gets the short straw, despite being the RPI leader of the three, and ends up on the three line, but all three at this moment would be in the tournament. We have them projected that way. Last team, Jeff, before we get out of here, Oklahoma State. They make their rankings debut in week 13 at number 25. They have won a ton of games recently. This is the best baseball Oklahoma State has played in some time in the regular season. Over the last 10, they're 7-3. They're now 6-8 in quad one, 7-4 in quad two. And they're coming off of what was a really exciting sweep at home of TCU, in which they came back in game three and ended up winning 11-10 after trailing, I believe it was 9-6 or 9-2, 3 early on in the game, something like that. And then they ended up having a burst of 5 or 6 runs later in the game to win it. This is a fun Oklahoma State team. They have some talent. I know where you're headed with this. Some of the metrics, at least on the surface level, are not great, but very Arizona State-like on the mound. And the fact that they know how to miss their bats, even if they don't necessarily have a great ERA.
I think I might even like the staff more than I like Arizona State's staff, frankly, even though the numbers don't back it. The offense, though, is right there with Arizona State. You know, a couple points behind them. They're not in the top 10 in WOBA, but right outside of it at 11, 407 team WOBA. They slug. They can hit with anybody. That obviously works in this conference, as we've talked about with a few teams at this point in the Big 12. But have had impressive back-to-back weekends, you know, sweeping Texas Tech at Texas Tech, sweeping TCU at home, who was a preseason favorite. Now, you know, they get Arizona, they get the Arizona tour. They get Arizona Arizona State in Arizona, in Phoenix. That's a tough series. We talked about that at the beginning of the segment. Then they kind of get in a nicer cushion at the end of the year here, though. It's another one of these series that, if you know, they drop to Arizona at home, that will probably hurt them quite a bit. But they're playing good baseball. We believe in the lineup. They're going to produce runs. And they have some big series wins. They have some big series sweeps. They have a Cincinnati sweep from the beginning of April as well. We just talked about Cincinnati. So kind of all beating each other up. Couldn't take 2 out of 3 from Kansas, but did play them pretty tough in that series and took a Friday night game. This is their first time in the top 25, and I think they're a team that's been turning up for a bit. And we always thought there was talent there.
Yeah, no, we have been talking about Oklahoma State as a team with talent. There are a number of players, Con Ritchie, Con Brugman, not necessarily the best hitter for average, but my goodness, when he connects, does that ball go? And Ethan Lund, their Friday starter, not a pretty ERA, kind of a reflection of the staff in one player, not exactly a pretty ERA. His fair share of walks, but he has excellent stuff and misses a ton of bats. So, yes, Oklahoma State in a pretty decent spot now in the picture. Jeff, that is going to do it for this week's episode of the College Podcast. Some things that I want to point out that are coming right now. We've got a ton of content. SEC Tournament is around the corner. We will have some things that are previewing that. We will have things that are previewing the bubble every week now. We will have Bubble Watch at Baseball America. We have the Cinderella Watch, where teams that we're trying to project out to have a good chance to make a surprising run in Omaha, plus some other regularly scheduled things that are popping up every here and there. News, ABS, we talked about that earlier in the show. So keep it locked at baseballamerica.com. For Jeff Ponce, I'm Jacob Rudner, and we will see you next time.